Welcome to the Intelligence and National Security Summit discussion on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller, your host. My guest today is Randy Fort, the Director of Program Security at Raytheon and a former Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research. Randy is co-leading the innovation track for the Intelligence and National Security Summit being held September 9th and 10th in Washington, D.C., co-hosted by FCEA and INSA. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Glad to be here.
So your track is pretty cool. We've had technology, we've had policy, now we're doing innovation, and you get all the cool toys to talk about, UAVs, 3D printing, other leading-edge, cutting-edge technologies. Talk a little bit about how the world is shifting and how the track is discussing it.
Well, thanks, Jason. The idea was to try to do something that would capture some of the changes in technology, exponentially changing technology that we're witnessing on a daily basis, and to be able to present some of those technologies in terms of demonstrations and presentations by the companies and by the individuals that are actively involved in bringing those technologies into fruition. So we wanted to have something. Typically, a lot of these panels are my way of looking at being a bunch of guys sitting around talking. So we actually wanted to do something more direct and more visual to be able to present the reality of some of these new technologies.
If you think about UAVs, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles, you talk about 3D printing, a lot of this is really changing the way we look at things. I saw, for example, a gun that was done by a 3D printer and how easily that was done. And then they shot it as an example. And it was like, whoa, somebody at home could potentially do this.
Well, when we were originally coming up with a list of technologies that we could usefully present, we had quite a lengthy list because there are a number of things that that are rushing towards us at almost frightening rates of speed. But trying to come up with some technologies that were more easily demonstrable in a forum like we're going to have became part of the challenge. For example, one of the most important new technologies and new capabilities that we'll be seeing in the years to come is the Internet of Things. But it's very hard to portray that or present that in a tangible way. So we tried to focus on things that were more more easily presentable, more tactile, if you will, and certainly 3D printing is one of those. As you say, firearms are just one of the many things. Actually, as I've thought about 3D printing, you can look ahead 10 or 20 years, and theoretically the entire supply chain will have two steps. You will go from the IP that is created by whoever can write the code, and then you will go to the consumer. So you think about all the supply chain that goes between manufacturing and consumption now, and that, at least on a theoretical basis, could just simply be obliterated. And that will have a huge impact on our economy, on consumption, on many, many new aspects. And when you get to the things that can be 3D printed, when you get to not just inanimate objects, but actually body organs and other things, we are looking at a true revolution coming down the road.
I want to go back to the Internet of Things for a second. One of the interesting aspects of this concept is the government in many ways is already doing the Internet of Things. If you talk about sensors in the ocean, the DoD has RFID tags, you know, to do logistics. All of that's kind of here, but the real next step is bringing it all together. I mean, is that how the Internet of Things is part of this innovation track to talk about?
Well, I don't know that we're going to talk about Internet of Things in any great specificity. I'm sure it'll come up in our closing track where we have a panel, very thoughtful and very accomplished speakers that will be talking about a number of technologies, not just the ones we've actually demoed and presented in the prior day. And because the Internet of Things is going to be one of these things that will synthesize and integrate so many of these other capabilities. As you say, there's a lot of today there's anywhere from the numbers sort of vary, 10 billion, 15 billion objects that are connected. Those numbers will go upwards of like 50 billion by 2020. And I've seen estimates as much as a trillion devices around the world interconnected by 2030. I think we'll probably in the next, you know, 5, 10, and 15 years be astonished at how many devices actually are connected. And the real innovation in this will be everything will be connected laterally and horizontally, not just vertically to whatever the controlling system was, which is kind of how we think of things today. So there will be all this crosstalk going on between untold billions and maybe even trillions of devices. And I think the outcome of that in terms of the capabilities and challenges, vulnerabilities, and so forth are unimaginable at this point.
One of the interesting things about the way the cutting edge technology are coming to bear is things are being used in a way that you're not expecting them to be, like the Apple Watch. Well, if you just connect it back to for a police station or for a Customs and Border Protection agent who's wearing an Apple Watch, you can see, oh, your heart rate baseline is usually 75. All of a sudden, it's 120. What's going on? That's an example Wolf Tombi uses from CBP quite often.
Absolutely, Jason. I think you're spot on, and that's one of both the challenge and the opportunity of these technologies. Any one of them, if you're talking about 3D printing, autonomous systems, virtual reality, Internet of Things, they are astonishing just in and of themselves and the capabilities that they will bring. But when those capabilities merge and interact and intersect, there will be new insights that will simply be unimaginable until those different capabilities are mixed together. And so the biometric analysis coming off of a Fitbit, or even there have been articles about your smartphone knows. Your smartphone knows whether you're happy, whether you're sad, whether you're overweight, whether you're this, whether you're that. And it knows because of just this wealth of data that is being generated by each one of these devices and whoever is carrying them on a routine basis.
One thing about this supply chain I want to go back to that you mentioned is the impact on government contractors, the impact on DOD and the intelligence community, and more broadly, obviously, impact on government. Let's start with the government contractors. The supply chain, the way you described it, is you go from need to delivery almost because of 3D printing is one example. How are the contracting community kind of preparing for these leading edge technologies?
Well, I think depending on the companies you're talking about, certainly the major defense contractors, and including my own company, are investing heavily in both research and development for additive manufacturing, as it's called, or 3D printing. They're the same. And because it will be a more economical, more efficient way to create things. When you 3D print, there is zero waste. Most manufacture is about taking something away from a mass of material, and so there's always shavings or dust or, you know, the residual slag. And with 3D printing, only the precise amount that's needed for any particular object is ever actually used. And so cheaper in materials, cheaper in energy. You can customize things. You can make things one-off. You can create shapes and forms and sizes that are unmachinable using normal types of grinding. You can't, for example, drill a 90-degree angle, but you can 3D print a 90-degree angle because you just program it, so as one example. So there will be, I think, staggering efficiencies that will come about, which means that contractors and government contractors will be able to deliver more value to government customers at faster rates, because it's much quicker to 3D print things than to have to go through the normal manufacturing process. It'll be cheaper. And so there will be a number of benefits, I think, coming out of that.
Beyond 3D printing, there's other technologies. We talked about IoT. I know a lot of vendors are interested in IoT. Are there other things that are going to happen based on this innovation that we're seeing that's going to impact the government contracting community?
Oh, I think all of these things are going to combine. When you get into the big data sets that are being generated and the predictive analytics that will come out of that, the virtual reality systems that we actually have a member of our third panel, who Bruce Harris with Microsoft, they've just recently introduced their HoloLens virtual reality system. There are a number of other competing ones that are going on out there right now. And virtual reality will change the world of training, of communication, education in so many profound ways imagine, why would you have to go get on an airplane to go to a meeting somewhere if you could just put on your visor and then go be in a space and be able to sit virtually with a round table of the people you would otherwise be traveling to meet and be able to do all the normal interactions, only it's all being done virtually. So there's a number of, I think, very profound changes that will affect all of these entities across the board.
Let's not lose sight. The fact is, the human touch is still important. We don't want to go there where everyone wants virtual reality and no one ever has to leave their
earth. Well, I understand. But, you know, it's interesting today. If you watch young people walking down the street, they may be texting each other rather than actually having a face-to-face conversation. And increasingly, the virtual venues, be it Facebook or Instagram or any of these other venues for communicating, seem to be the preferred way of sharing information and interacting. And so I think the virtual reality reality will just be a natural extension of that. I certainly hope we don't give up human touch and honest-to-God face-to-face communication, but the technology will certainly enable that.
Let's move over to the DoD, the intelligence community, the government more general. This is going to impact them as well. One of the things you said is efficiency, effectiveness, cheaper to buy products and potentially services. But that's also going to have an effect on how they do their business, too. You mentioned training. Are there some other ways that the government should be, you know, kind of keeping an eye on how these innovations are progressing?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, to the government's credit, you have organizations like DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has been in the forefront of investing and nurturing and encouraging the predecessors and the precursors of a lot of these technologies over the years, and other government agencies as well. I just cite them as one example. But I think part of the challenge for government will be to understand that a lot of their legacy bureaucratic procedures and processes and rules and regulations, most of which are sort of mid-20th to late 20th century in origin and in background, are simply going to need to be fundamentally realigned and rethought and rearticulated in order to keep up with the scale, the pace, and the capabilities that these new technologies offer. The Moore's Law curve, every 12 to 18 months, the capacity of a computer chip doubles. That's been going on for many, many decades. And it's also become a metaphor for so many of these technologies, which continue to morph and grow and change at that similar kind of exponential rate. You know, when you go from 1 to 30 arithmetically, you get to 30. When you go from 1 to 30 exponentially, you get to a billion. And that is one of the single most important things that I think the government officials are going to need to keep in mind, that these technologies are extremely dynamic. They are growing very rapidly, and many of the decision-making systems and procedures are not constructed in a way that it can keep pace with the changes in technology. And so that's going to be a challenge, I think, for the government going forward.
And actually, it was a great segue to this idea of what needs to change: legislation, acquisition, processes, how industry sells. I know all of the above. So let me start with, I think, the acquisition process, because I think that's probably the biggest key here. How does the acquisition process, from your perspective, need to change?
Well, so first of all, full disclosure, I am not an acquisitions, authority, but I've been in Washington for almost 40 years, and I've certainly watched my share of acquisition related issues, both good and also those that would fall into sort of the debacle category. I think the government has demonstrated the ability to move with great agility and great speed when the circumstances were right. When you think back on some of the stealth programs, the F-117, the B-2 bomber, those were all done in the black, so to speak, very secret, especially controlled compartments at the time. They were able to gather the technologies and put all that into operation very, very quickly. Going back even to the 1950s, the U-2, the SR-71, and some of the other National Reconnaissance Program efforts were all turned around very, very quickly, and in a time long before we have the kind of computers and devices and digital technologies that we have today. So perhaps it's a matter of the government kind of going back to the future, going back to some of their earlier roots of special programs and studying those procedures, and then migrating those forward into the 21st century to recognize that having, 47 layers of review and being completely risk-averse, changing to a fail-fast instead of a zero-risk-never-fail sort of mentality, for example, on some of these things will be the way to go. But I think the history is there if they choose to learn from it.
My guest today is Randy Fort, the Director of Programs and Security at Raytheon and a former Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research. Randy is co-leading the innovation track for the Intelligence and National Security Summit being held in Washington, D.C., September 9th and 10th, co-hosted by FCA and INSA. I'm Jason Miller, your host, and you're listening to the Intelligence and National Security Summit discussion on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We talked about the acquisition process. That's always a big one. But there's also legislation. There's also processes that need to change. Talk about what else within the government's perspective you think also needs to shift to meet these new technologies, these new innovations.
Well, that's one of the things we hope to be a spark or a catalyst for, Jason, is by presenting some of these technologies and what their capabilities are and how they may come to mix and match and integrate, that government officials who will be attending the summit will start to consider and start to realize that old ways of doing business will simply be insufficient. So on the acquisition side, former Deputy Secretary of Defense in an article in Foreign Affairs back in 2010 indicated it took 82 months for, which is almost four and three quarters years, for the DOD to make even a vanilla a computer acquisition. Meanwhile, the technology is doubling every 18 months, which only guarantees that obsolete systems are being bought by the Department of Defense on those timescales. So the acquisition process will need to be more agile and have shorter timeframes. Legislatively, the Congress is spending a lot of time talking about acquisition reform, but I think the private sector, as well as some of the government agencies, are going to need to be working very hard to make sure the legislators have all the information about what these technologies are and their implications. And then there's another area that these technologies are going to impose, and that's just the operational realities, both in terms of the policymaking and the decision making, as well as how these technologies are used out in the field. I've seen one example of, in the future, an airplane will have a 3D printer on board and it'll be able to 3D print a missile that it will then be able to shoot either offensively or defensively. And so you can imagine, what does that do to supply chains and to tactical doctrine and all these variables that will be very different from the standard sort of models and ways of thinking about these things.
As we've seen with the cyber, if you will, warfare, if you want to call it that, the back and forth between the U.S. and some of its frenemies, whether it's China or Russia or even places like Israel, where there's spying that's happening, this changes how you approach things. I mean, is that discussion happening?
Well, I think on the cyber arena that you raised, and there is a separate track on cyber at the event, not for the innovation, but those conversations are taking place on a state-to-state basis and discussion of what should be appropriate norms or rules of the road. Other of these technologies, in particular autonomous systems, are also beginning to get new attention because is it ethical to have a robot kill somebody, for example? This is one of the things, if you arm a drone, currently the unmanned aerial vehicles that are being used, for example, to prosecute the global war on terrorism are unmanned, but there are human controllers that are actually flying them and a human is pulling the trigger. Well, what happens if you have one of these things flying around for, a month at a time and it's completely autonomous, and if it sees a target that meets the parameters, is a human necessarily always in the loop? And so this is another area, and as these systems grow smaller and smaller, I mean, you can think of swarms of nanobots, for example, and unleashing them. What would that mean in the future? How do the laws of armed conflict apply? How do the Geneva Conventions apply? What do we, what are the understandings and agreements going to be? So I think this is going to take a lot of work. One of my former professional homes of the Department of State to engage in a lot of diplomatic discussions around the world with key countries and key organizations to come up with some understandings about what actually makes sense.
It's getting to the point where, as you're right, decisions have to be made around, for instance, well, what if you have a UAV that's not being controlled by a human all the time, and the computer makes a decision based on, facial recognition that's a target and it launches a missile. So I think it's a fascinating example.
Well, it could make a determination based on facial recognition, based on walk, based on gait, based on weight, based on heartbeat, potentially on DNA, various other human ephemera. All of those things would go to give, a high confidence that target was indeed the person that was being looked at. Your point about science fiction, I actually have a file that I maintain. I call it my Star Trek file. All of the Star Trek, going back to the original series with Captain Kirk all the way through the others, the different technologies that were hypothesized or theorized in those television shows, and they're real today. So you have the replicator, that's 3D printing. You have a holodeck, that's virtual reality. You have a phaser, that's directed energy. Tractor beams are being demonstrated in the lab. I just saw an article the other week that warp drive may be actually possible, and on and on and on. And so Gene Roddenberry's imagination 40 and 50 years ago is today, you know, there are real manifestations of many of those wondrous devices that we thought were, you know, impossible or science fiction back in that era. And it, and when you add in the other movies, indeed, the reality is catching up with the imagination.
So please tell me they're going to demonstrate the phaser at the FCA Summit, because I will come just for that. I know it's a joke, but tell me some of the technologies you are excited about that they're talking about, you know, in the lab, in the alpha development stage, that they're going to talk about at this at the event.
Well, we have a number of technologies, 3D printing and autonomous systems. In particular, we have a company that is also big data and looking at social media. There's a one company called Dataminer that has access to the unedited, unexpurgated Twitter feed. And it turns out, because I've seen their presentation previously, it turns out Twitter is the central nervous system for the planet Earth. And so a sparrow doesn't fall or nothing seems to happen that there isn't a tweet about it somewhere. I've joked that if someone got in an accident and was arterially bleeding, they would take a picture of it and post it to Twitter before they would call 911 to save their own life. It's just the way the world is working. And so in terms of indications and warning and alerting what's going on around the world, they've demonstrated an ability to know literally within seconds almost anything that's happening and to be able to look through that Niagara Falls of data that's happening every second and call out the salient bits of data and turn that into real and useful actionable information. So that's an example. We have some companies that are involved in 3D printing, also autonomous systems. We started off with a very large array of possibilities, but we had to sort of neck down to those companies that were willing to come in and talk about their products. You get into an intellectual property and proprietary and that sort of thing. So they had to be willing to, you know, present to an audience of hundreds and have news media attention. But I think we found some very interesting partners to come, and it should be a very interesting, exciting session.
So when you look at some of the speakers, you talk to some of the technologies, who are some of the speakers that you're most interested in hearing from?
Well, especially on our third panel, we tried to come up with a range of folks in different perspectives. So Lewis Shepard, who used to be with Microsoft, and their government institute is going to moderate. We have David Bray, who is the Chief Information Officer at the Federal Communications Commission, brilliant young man who is probably of all of the government IT, government technology people I've come across in many, many years, is one of the most thoughtful and articulate and forward-looking. We have Aaron Frank, who is with the Singularity University, which was a group that the futurist Ray Kurzweil helped found a number of years ago, and they are doing, I think, just some astonishing work about the implications of a range of these technologies. Bruce Harris with Microsoft, he is playing a lead role in their virtual reality development, so he'll be able to talk very knowledgeably about that. And Jason Thomas with Thomson Reuters, who has done some fascinating work on some of these new technologies, in particular how gaming and other applications are sort of crossing over into the real world, and you know, where does reality stop and virtual begin, where does, you know, the fantasy and physical and he's done some excellent work there. So I think that's going to be a fascinating panel that will look across a range of these technologies and be able to give some great perspectives.
And in fact, just recently, you all got confirmed a new plenary speaker. Who just confirmed, and how excited are you to see this person?
Well, one of the really great things about this summit is that we've been able to invite and receive the support of a number of the key leaders in the intelligence community. And just recently, within the last day or so, General Vince Stewart, who's the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, has agreed to come and participate in one of the plenary sessions. So we will be able to get that very valuable perspective, since DIA is one of the critical so-called three-letter agencies in the intelligence community. He's relatively new on the job, and so I think it'll be particularly interesting to hear his perspective as he's gotten into the position and where he sees the future going.
When you talk about the innovation track more specifically, what do you want people to get out of it? What do you hope they walk away from the sessions with?
Well, I think my objective and that of my colleague, Bob Farrell, who was my co-chairman as we put this together, was to open eyes and to make people present to people some of the things that are going on. And here is the art of the possible, and to stimulate thinking about the reality of these technologies, their potential impacts, how they will affect business, how they will affect someone's immediate business concerns or operational concerns, but how they will impact more broadly across the intelligence community, across the government, and in business, and hopefully start a dialogue and a conversation and getting people asking questions and going out and seeking out more research and bringing these kinds of things to the attention of the people they work with. And so this is about, I think, planting seeds, and hopefully we'll see some of them germinate in the future.
Do you feel like from an innovation perspective, you're talking about these technologies at the right time?
I certainly hope so. I don't think there's ever not a good time to talk about innovation and some of these technologies. You know, as I indicated before, they're changing so rapidly. So if we have the conversation today, if I were to come back in 3 months or 6 months, we would be talking about something that may be 50%, 75%, or even 100% better, faster, more, cheaper, smaller, you know, something along those lines. So I think our understanding and our comprehension of these technologies lags behind the reality of the technology change. So at any point where we can have these conversations and bring them to people's attention, I think that's probably a good thing.
And that's why I was a little surprised. You said you had all these ideas, and then you had to kind of figure out who'd come talk about it. I figured everyone would want to come talk about it.
Well, as I said, the reality is, you know, companies that are doing some very, very interesting things have to think about, do I really want to, you know, show my ankles at a large event that will be publicly attended and hundreds of people? How much of my proprietary or, R&D type intellectual property do I really want to present at that? So we went to a large group of companies and had to sort of neck down in terms of, you know, who was available, who was willing, what technologies could we most easily present, given that we have to do, you know, we're not going to be in a laboratory. We're going to be in a large sort of meeting room at the convention center. And, you know, what could be presented by video or those kinds of presentations. So that kind of ended up culling out some of those things. But we had, I mean, you think about some of the technologies, transparent electronics, robotics, nanophotonics, plasmonic chips, nanoionics, strain-tronics, spin neurons, graphene nanoelectronics. I mean, all these things are, I just sound like I made up a bunch of words. Those are all real things that are being done in real labs and real companies, and will change our world in ways that we can't imagine in the years to come. But we had to, you know, we had to come up with a list and make that real. So this was where we ended up.
Randy Fort, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Jason. My pleasure to be here.
It sounds like a very exciting day, very exciting conference. I've got to talk to all three track chairs. You can find all those interviews on federalnewsradio.com. For more information on the Intelligence and National Security Summit, visit intelsummit.org. You've been listening to the Intelligence and National Security Summit discussion on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.